Position number 16395, Reel 5.
General Crookenden, Reel 5.
We crossed the channel, by steamer, of course, and found ourselves in southern Belgium, in the R10, living in a billeted for one night, two nights, in a big monastery. And I discovered very quickly that we were in the middle of the 2nd Army, and that just up the road was the 53rd Welsh Division, which the GSO 1, the Chief Staff Officer, was a very old friend of mine, Charles Harrington, also originally from the Cheshire Regiment. So I rang him up on the radio, and he said, "Come and have dinner. MS, you're not moving till tomorrow anyway." So I took my Jeep, I picked him up from his billet, and drove off to where his MS was for dinner. I was driving, he was sitting beside me. Now the battle had receded some way away from that part of Belgium, central Belgium. And so I was driving, perhaps rather stupidly, with headlights on. And a German night fighter dived on us down the road, firing his cannon at us. And I could see the twinkling of the shell bursts on the road coming towards us as we drove down the road, and the aircraft then roared away over our heads. One cannon shell went through the windscreen and took off my beret of the truck. And because of the windscreen shattering, filled my eyes with glass. I stopped the truck without too much difficulty on the left of the road. Charlie Harrington, took over and drove me straight to his divisional headquarters, where I had first aid from one of our doctors, and I was taken into a hospital in Brussels for a final cleaning up of the eyes. And I remember that as quite amusing, because it coincided with Christmas Eve. Or was it New Year's? Can't remember. I was in a big ward in a Brussels hospital full of officers, most of them badly wounded. And one chap in the next bed to me, covered from head to foot in bandages over his face, arms, legs, everything. And beautiful Belgian ladies, quite often during the day and the next day, came round to see the gallant British officers. And they always stopped by this man's bed to ask him how badly he'd been wounded and where. And he had to confess that he'd fallen downstairs on Christmas night and had smashed himself to pieces in doing so. However, I was restored to health, went back to my battalion. We took up positions in the Ardennes, and the American army, with great gallantry, in my opinion, had in fact already stopped the main German advance of their armored divisions, and our job merely to follow up the Germans as they withdrew. We sat in intense cold, 28 degrees of frost, on top of a hill in the Ardennes called Marche, a village of Marche. And then, when we advanced next day, or was it 2 days later, we came into the Ardennes village of Bond. The village, small one, really one main street running down a hill, and a church and a row of houses, and the bottom of the hill on the main road through the Ardennes was another section of the village and a garage, but all totally smashed down and been set alight, all blackened ruins. And the village people were extraordinarily down, silent, no cheering the liberators or anything of that sort. And to cut a long story short, I was told by that on Christmas Day, the Germans had come into the church. Really, as the people came out of church, they'd taken all the men, and there weren't many men there, all the men between the ages of sort of 18 and 45 had been already out coming home on Earth. But all the other youths and old men had been taken away for forced labour in Germany. And the village were desperate because they had any women and children left, bitterly cold, they had no food, and so on. So we sent out people from the companies, we shot several deer and fed the village from army rations. And B Company, who'd been searching the whole area, came up the hill from the ruined section of the village in the valley to say, "You better come and look at this, sir." And there, in the cellar of the garage, were all the remaining men of the village lying in a heap, shot through the back of the neck. Became known later as the Bourne Massacre. And we had the then difficult task of going up the village and getting all the householders, or one person from each house, to come and identify the dead. They had a funeral mass. We produced, with the help of the local people, coffins for all the victims. We and all our men took part in the funeral service and so on, and loaded the coffins onto our trucks, taken away to the local burial ground. What sticks in my mind was the extraordinary resilience of those Belgian villagers. Since when we'd marched into the village the evening before, they hadn't cheered or waved, but because of the bitter cold, practically all my men were in either the sheds or in the huts themselves, and many of those women, having just lost their men, were giving them coffee and fire, warmth, and so on. They were the most marvelous people. And today, some of our 9th Battalion people of that battalion, old men, go back there every year and are warmly welcomed by the village. So that was the Ardennes. And then we moved on from there into Holland, where we were holding the line of the River Maas. The Germans had opened the sluice gates much higher up the river. The whole of the countryside was flooded. The Maas was in flood, and we had to hold the village of Hoorn, a Dutch village, in the appendix below Holland, south of Holland, opposite the town of Roermond, where we spent our time patrolling in boats, trying to keep warm, and patrolling across the river into Germany and into the area held by the German 7th Parachute Division. Only one German patrol was effective against us. Elements of a patrol of the German 7th Parachute Division came over the flooded Maas in a rubber boat and punctured themselves on the barbed wire surrounding one of my companies, which was operating in an isolated farm. It was actually one of our outposts. The farm itself also now surrounded with water. And this German patrol, quite bold fellows, got itself punctured and captured. And I remember it particularly because a fair-haired young officer was running their patrol. He was brought in front of me. I could speak fluent German. And we had a drill. My intelligence officer, who'd in peacetime run a greyhound racing track in Newcastle on Tyne, and was as tough as old boots. He would march any prisoner we wanted to interview in front of me with a lot of shouting, and "This is the colonel, look out, very senior officer," all that stuff which impresses Germans. I would ask him where was his unit, what was the map reference of his headquarters and their unit positions. And one of the very few Germans who ever refused to give us that information was this young officer, who was rather overbearing, told us we would not last long with his lot opposed to us, and so on. So I had a drill with Mike Glynn. If he wouldn't answer my questions, I would nod to Mike, and Mike would pull out a huge flick knife, and I would then look at this prisoner and said, I give you one last chance to answer all my questions, or the worse for you. Now, all the German army were taught that parachute troops would certainly kill them if they were taken prisoner, because good old idiot Hitler had issued an army-wide order that all British commando or parachute troops on capture would be shot. I mean, a very stupid thing to do. So our business of interrogation, our job of interrogate prisoners, was made very easy, because that's the only officer I ever remember, only man, who ever refused to say anything. When I made this pantomime, he laughed and said, that's a lot of bullshit. I know perfectly well you're not going to touch me. You know as well as I do, I give you name, rank, and number, nothing else. So we kicked him up the arse and sent him back to a prison of war camp. We never, in fact, touched a prisoner all through the war, but we never had any trouble in getting what we wanted. Then we all came back to England to get some more men and to retrain for, this was March, the Rhine crossing. The next job was to cross the Rhine, the 6th Airborne Division and the 17th United States Airborne Division, flying in side by side and dropping onto the rear defences of the German army holding the Rhine, the gun areas, overlooking the plain of the River Rhine, the flat lands, was in that area, just north of Wesel, a high wooded ridge called the Schneppenberg, where most of the German gun areas were situated, firing onto anybody crossing the river. And our job was to land on top of them and silence them. In September 1944, the 1st Airborne Division had been prevented from carrying out that task of capturing the bridges over the River Rhine because they'd been dropped 8 miles from their objective, 3 to 4 hours march. And if you give the Germans 3 to 4 hours, they react very quickly, as they did in defeating the 1st Airborne Division. This time we were to drop right on top of the German defences, relying on the fact that 2 complete divisions, that's 4 parachute brigades, 2 glider brigades, we'd all land on top of them in one motion. And this time we had enough aircraft to carry both divisions in one lift. We were going to saturate the air with gliders and bodies. And it worked extremely well. We were flying from airfields in East Anglia. Our tragic camp before takeoff for my battalion was the Mushroom Farm at Wethersfield in Essex. And we were flying in United States troop carrying aircraft, the 9th Troop Carrier Command, a group of highly efficient pilots and air crews trained to fly in very tight formation and to drop accurately in the right place. A highly disciplined, very efficient form of air transport. The usual business, we were locked into the Mushroom Farm for a week. We briefed all the soldiers, nobody was allowed out, except for me. I was taken over the day before to brief the air crews of this American troop carrier group. And the colonel, a bird colonel, received me very handsomely. I addressed all his crews and told him what our task was, how we were going to do it. And he ended, turned to me and said, well, Colonel Fax, I guess you'll be flying with me in the lead ship, meaning the leading aircraft. And as they flew in arrowhead formation, their colonel, flying in the leading aircraft of the whole formation of 40 aircraft, was a natural target for every German anti-aircraft gunner in sight. So I said, no, I'm planning to fly right in the middle of the formation where my aircraft is least likely to get hit, and I will land in the middle of my battalion group where I'm more easily established to establish quick control of all my men. and I'm quite certain he thought I was windy. Anyhow, we took off at about 7 in the morning. We were due to land at 10. And for the first time, we, the airborne troops, were landing after the seaborne troops, the main army, had crossed the Rhine, so as to knock off the German gun lines, artillery, while they were just coming ashore in the early morning. It was a very fine piece of flying. We all arrived at Wethersfield at about 6 o'clock in the morning, the airfield. All the Dakotas were lined up around the perimeter track. All my men got in, put on their chutes, and I went with my jeep on a quick drive around the line of aircraft to check that all was well with my battalion. And as I got in my jeep to do this, from the far end of this aircraft line, I heard the sound of a shot. So I drove down there to see what the hell was up. I thought some ass had fired his rifle by mistake. But it wasn't. It was one of my best sergeants from Normandy, a splendid section and platoon leader, brave as a lion, had shot himself in the foot. Why? Because his wife had written him a letter saying, if you jump again, I shall leave you. So he was rushed away, mended, and put in a military prison for the standard 84 days. Great pity and great tragedy. However, then all those 40-odd aircraft started up their engines, and the aircraft started taxiing in a great thundering queue round the perimeter track onto the runway. And as they got on the runway, they lined up three aircraft at a time, three aircraft together, so close that the second and third aircraft had their wings tucked right in behind the wings of the lead aircraft. And on the given green light from the tower, the control tower, the first three set off down the runway together. And almost immediately behind them, the next three, and the next three, and the next three. A mass takeoff by those American transport crews was the most exhilarating and impressive performance. We formed up over East Anglia and then set course across the channel. Our crew chief, an American warrant officer, stood in the open door at the back, giving us an excellent running commentary on everything below us as we crossed the channel. We flew over the great gun emplacements, the German gun emplacements of the cross-channel guns near Cap Grenet. And then we flew over the huge concrete emplacements for the flying bombs. We were all huddled up in our seats with this massive equipment belted around us. The tea container passed up and down the line of men. And the urine tin, not a very modern aircraft, if you wanted to pass water, you had to burrow down through your equipment, jump jacket, airborne smock, trousers, and then use this urine tin. Occasional, not very many by this time, sick bag went up and down for those who felt air sick. And everybody started singing. But as we got closer and closer to the scene of action, the singing died away. A lot of men went to sleep. They always did. But then we reached the Belgian town of Wavre, and there we turned to port to head northeast for the Rhine River. Now, I was sitting opposite the open door on the port side, and there was a window on the starboard side. And looking out of the door, right back to beyond the horizon, you could see the other aircraft and gliders of our 6th Airborne Division coming up over the horizon, and this vast armada stretching back to the northwest. And out of the window on my other side, I could see the American 17th Airborne Division coming up out of the sky, right from the horizon, way down to the southwest. Extraordinary air armada. And above us, and round about us and wheeling below us were the fighters of our RAF escort. So it were both, we were flying, I should add, in nine ship-wide elements, nine aircraft in a great arrow, and then another nine, another nine, another nine, and the Americans were the same. So as we turned over Wav, 18 aircraft in a row flew on towards the Rhine. 4 minutes from the drop, as agreed, the red light came on. We stood up, hooked up our parachute straps on the overhead cable, turned towards the door, turns aft, and as was the drill, each man checked his strap hook, the hook on the line. The man in front of him made certain the safety pin, which stops the hook undoing by mistake. And then from the back, number 18 of the aircraft, they all shouted out, number one, ready, number two, number three, number four, number five, so on up to 18. Then we passed over the terrible ruins of those German towns like Goch, the result of the Reichswald battle. And then I was jumping number one. I could see the great curving river of the Rhine below us, and then almost immediately ahead of us, our dropping zone, exactly as our maps and models had depicted. And on the ground, the parachutes of our other two battalions in the brigade, 8th Parachute Battalion, the Canadian Parachute Battalion, who jumped 3 minutes before us, already on the ground, and men running in towards their objectives. And then the green light came on, and out we all went. I went, I remember, into the sunlight and down into this beautiful day, this March day. You could hear the occasional crack of a bullet going quite close, not very many. And then I was down on the ground. I made my usual backward landings, picked myself up, looked around for my batman and my escort. We used our PT Sarmatas as my escort, and found the VZ full of my own men making towards our rendezvous, the far right corner. The sign of battle, where 8th Parachute Battalion were already clearing Germans from their positions round the dropping zone, and the same with the Canadians. And then I could see, to my pleasure and delight, in our planned rendezvous in the corner of this open field, surrounded by woods, the blue smoke going up, which was our rendezvous signal, put there by the regimental sergeant major, and made my way across there. By this time, men were coming in very well, my own men from all over the drop zone. And an indication of how you feel in battle, because we had to move off as soon as we were strong enough, enough men were in, to capture our first objective, which was a German gun battery on top of that hill, I urgently wanted to get my mortar base plates, get my mortars into action, so that as we moved off, I had something which to give us covering fire with my own mortars. And as I stood there watching the men coming in and being allotted by the RSM to their different company areas for immediate defense of our rendezvous, I saw a soldier from the mortar platoon going past. So I grabbed him by the arm and said, "Where's Mr. Jefferson?" The mortar platoon commander, who in peacetime life was a ballet dancer and a very good officer. "Oh," he said, "he's bolted, sir. Terrible mess. Right through the head. Head blown nearly off." And instead of saying, "Damn, I've lost Mr. Jefferson, splendid chap," I remember feeling strongly, "What a curse! No mortar officer. Well, where's the mortar sergeant?" In other words, I had ceased to worry about my friends. I wanted to get the mortars into action. But happily, at that moment, through the wood, to me and the rendezvous, Alan Jefferson, the mortar officer, came prancing through the wood with his typical ballet dancer's walk, saying, "Good morning, Colonel. What a lovely day." I mean, some private soldiers do love bad news, and this chap's bad news about Alan Jefferson was totally false, much to my relief. After about half an hour, we had a very high proportion. 45-50% of the battalion had arrived and were organized by their companies, including my own soldier servant, Lance Corporal Wilson, who arrived riding a horse he'd liberated from a nearby farm with another one for me. So we mounted and we set off through the woods against our first objective, this German gun battery. On the way, we passed one of our own gliders, which had crashed and turned upside down on landing. Inside it was an artillery piece, our own artillery, and six gunners all dead, I'm sorry to say. But we eventually reached our final objective. We were coming in, of course, from the back of this battery. B Company, the leading company, followed by battalion headquarters, rushed into the battery, shot everybody who bothered to resist, silenced the battery, and then we established our positions in that area. One of my soldiers was standing over a German artillery captain lying dead on the ground. And as I passed, he said, "A fine pair of glasses, yes, sir." And I took a look at them, and they were beautiful, nice German artillery glasses. I said, "Well, that's a good pair." He said, "I can't make it work, sir." And what he'd done, he'd turned the eyepieces up to -5 on each side, so that you couldn't see anything through them. And I said, "Well, they're probably broken, but anyhow, I was rather busy. I meant to go on." He said, "Well, hey, you keep them, sir. They're no good to me." And I kept them till 25 years later, I lost them on Athens Airport. So we all established on our final positions by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was walking from A Company to B Company, my two forward companies, the usual layout, one, two companies forward, one in reserve, battalion headquarters in the middle. And our positions covered the main road from the Rhine running eastwards. And I was just going across the road, about 3:30, from B Company to A Company to see if all was well, when a jeep came up the road, flying a Union Jack, Army Jeep. And a Union Jack means the Army Group Commander. So I flagged it down, saluted, and said, "Crookenden, 9th Battleship Battalion, sir." And of course it was Monty. He said, "Good, good, 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 thank you, thank you. Crookenden, Crookenden, I know your father." And we had a 1 or 2 minutes chat, very few words. And then he motioned to his driver to drive on. So I said, "Stop, sir, just a minute. 50 yards around that bend is the next German position. This is the front line, you see. We've only just arrived here." "Oh," he said, "thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you." He always said everything 3 or 4 times. Turned round and drove back. But what moved me very much was that there was Monty running a colossal operation, crossing the Rhine by a complete army group. But that night, he took the trouble to write a postcard to my father, a retired colonel living in Berkshire, who we'd known for years, or most of his life, which ran like this. "My dear Arthur, I saw your boy and his battalion tonight, today, full stop. They were in good nick. Yours..."